Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Russia gets hit with more sanctions. Argentina may default on some debt. And whether or not you should talk about how much you make at work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, the 29th of July, and it's great to have you with us. President Obama announced another round of sanctions today, targeting Russia. The European Union also announced more sanctions. This time, the targets aren't just individuals in President Vladimir Putin's inner circle. New measures include an arms embargo and restrictions on the sale of technology and equipment to Russia's oil industry. And as Dan Bobkoff reports, there are fears the sanctions will have an adverse effect on American companies.
Until recently, the West has been reluctant to target whole sectors of the Russian economy. No longer, says Kenneth Yalowitz, a former U.S. ambassador to Belarus and Georgia, now with the Woodrow Wilson Center.
The shootdown of the Malaysian aircraft, I think, has changed the equation.
But the new EU sanctions and the U.S. ones already in place haven't hit American businesses as badly as some feared. Doug Redeker is a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute.
U.S. companies, if anything, breathed a little sigh of relief today that they were not going to be hung out relative to their European counterparts.
Russia is not a big trading partner with the U.S. Some companies like ExxonMobil and Citigroup might suffer. But the biggest risk, Redeker says, is retaliation against big brands like McDonald's.
Some health concerns, in quotes, that were expressed by Russian authorities.
Other potential targets include companies like Visa, MasterCard, and big U.S. accounting firms. David Levine of the law firm McDermott, Will & Emery says he sees little damage to U.S. companies so far.
Retaliatory sanctions against businesses in the West, to the extent there have been any, they haven't been very impactful.
A big question now is whether Western governments will have the stomach to continue sanctions for moral reasons, or whether trade and commercial interests will win out. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
President Obama announced those sanctions today on the South Lawn of the White House, and before he left Washington to start a trip to Kansas City, the president answered a reporter's question about whether or not this is a new Cold War.
It's not a new Cold War. What it is a very specific issue related to Russia's unwillingness to recognize that Ukraine can chart its own path.
So there you go. This news now from the Department of Phone Calls You Don't Want to Get, calls from debt collectors telling you you owe money. According to a new report, more than a third of all Americans with credit files had some kind of debt in collection last year, getting those phone calls. And all told, that's about 77 million consumers. The Urban Institute partnered with Encore Capital Group. That's the country's largest publicly traded buyer of consumer debt. They did the study together. And Marketplace's Chrissy Clark puts it in context.
When you have a debt that's sent into collection, you basically become, for the debt collector, a name on a spreadsheet.
My name is Gustavo Montoya. I work in the emergency room as a certified nursing assistant.
Gustavo Montoya's name ended up on one of these spreadsheets a few years ago. He'd taken a loan for $3,000 from Wells Fargo to help pay for living expenses while he was in school. Then, in 2011, he was contacted by another company he'd never even heard of who'd bought his debt. It turns out the selling of debt is common practice. The new company called him every day, and then another one did. He tried to explain that the economy was still bad, he was trying to find a job.
I was finding difficulty gaining employment. It was really stressful.
Beyond the stress, Suzanne Martindale with Consumers Union says falling into collection can have big repercussions. It can affect your credit score, your ability to get a loan in the future, even your ability to get a job.
Well, what can also happen is that debt may be passed around from one collector to another. It may be sold to another debt buyer. So you may find in a matter of months or a few years that there are different people from different companies all contacting you, claiming that they're the people that you owe the debt to.
Mark Schiffman is with the Association of Credit and Collection Professionals, an industry group. He says the collections process can be stressful, but it's also important to help keep the economy moving.
Businesses use those monies to pay their bills, to pay rent, to keep operational costs, to pay salaries.
But it seems these days just collecting the loans themselves can be big business, too. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all three of the big ones were down: NASDAQ, the Dow, and the S&P. Details when we do the numbers. Two decades ago, only about a tenth of urban Chinese families had a refrigerator. Today, you can find the appliance in close to 95% of their homes. So it's fair to say refrigeration is booming in China, and that's changing everyday life. Nicola Twilley's written about this for the New York Times Magazine, and she joins us now. Hi, Nicola.
Hi, David.
So the headline here, I suppose, is that we've got China surpassing the U.S. at something that it's led the world at for a very long time, and that is cold storage.
That's right. The United States is the first and most refrigerated nation in the world, but that's changing. By 2017, the Chinese will have about a billion cubic feet more cold storage than us.
I look back at the history of refrigeration. We got it as early as the 19th century, and I just wonder why it took China so long to catch up. Is it something that they've been working on or just ignored for a while?
Well, it's actually, they're refrigerating for the exact same reasons we did. The U.S. became majority urban in the 1910s. For China, that tipping point was 2011. You can't really feed an urban population of consumers without refrigeration. It's just that China didn't have to do that till now, and now it's having to do it really, really fast, almost overnight, as sort of 250 million farmers move to the cities.
Really fast. I mean, how difficult is it to build this infrastructure, to build these refrigeration warehouses and to build the facilities to get this food around the country?
Well, I mean, the government is subsidizing it, but it's still a challenge because all the parts of the cold chain is what the industry calls this sort of seamless refrigeration from farm to your domestic fridge. But all the parts of the cold chain have to be in place. It doesn't really matter if you have enough refrigerated warehouses if you don't have enough refrigerated trucks. And so that's what's proving a challenge in China right now. They're building it. They're building it as fast as they can. But connecting it all together is a different matter altogether.
You know, in the U.S., when we got refrigeration, it had almost immediate cultural changes. It changed the way we eat, what we could eat. And as you say, it's early there in China. But are we starting to see that happen?
Yeah, that's the most interesting aspect of this to me. It changes how you shop. So, you know, daily shopping at the wet market in China is beginning to be replaced by a weekly supermarket shop, the same way that we do in the U.S., and it changes what people think of as fresh. The older generation think that refrigerated meat can't possibly be fresh. My interpreter thought that the droplet on a packaging of frozen dumplings was a sign that it was fresh.
There are upsides to this, to refrigeration, and there are certainly downsides. Energy costs come to mind. You know, what's China wrestling with when it comes to refrigeration?
Yeah, well as all of the changes in, you know, how you shop and what you eat and those sorts of things, keeping food cold does require a lot of energy. Currently, cooling is estimated to make up 15% of global electricity consumption. So you can imagine that if China refrigerates to the same extent that the U.S. is refrigerated, that's an enormous amount of energy. However energy efficiently they build, and they're not necessarily building extremely energy efficiently right now. They're more sort of quickly trying to get it up there. So the energy use will go up with it.
Nicola Twilley is the author of What Do Chinese Dumplings Have to Do with Global Warming, which ran in the New York Times Magazine. And you can find a link to that article at our website, marketplace.org. Nicola, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
It's been unseasonably cool in Washington today. It didn't get hotter than 70-something, I think, but we have had some scorchers. During the summer, pools are packed, but fewer and fewer kids are signing up for swim teams. That's why USA Swimming, the national governing body of competitive swimming in the U.S., has kicked off an aggressive campaign to remind kids that swimming is, quote, the funnest sport there is. More fun than good grammar, I guess. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge reports.
One of the ads in the Swim Today campaign shows a girl dropping into a pool of blue water in slow motion.
Basketball, softball, cannonball. Which sounds the most fun to you?
Matt Farrell is a spokesman for USA Swimming. He says he wants kids to know there are other sports to consider. Farrell says their survey shows parents are one major problem in getting kids in the pool. He says 80% of parents overlook swimming when helping their kids choose an organized sport.
It was as if parents said, I've taught my kid to swim, I've checked the box, I'm a good parent, I've made them safe, now let's go play soccer, now let's go play basketball.
15-year-old Misha Neal of Durham, North Carolina, swims for her high school and for the YMCA. She remembers when it was time to make that big decision.
I guess I was doing a lot of sports at the time. I was also in gymnastics and track, and I had to pick. And I remember Daddy telling me that I was better at swimming.
USA Swimming is working to remind more kids of all the positives the sport has to offer, like teamwork, confidence, and health and fitness. And Misha has thrived, often coming in number one in the 50 freestyle. Mark Anthony Neal is Misha's dad. He says Misha adores her teammates and has overcome the obstacles of swimming competitively, even the hair issue.
We knew that my daughter was very serious about swimming. You know, when she was, you know, told matter-of-factly she wouldn't be able to get a perm, she wouldn't be able to put any chemicals in her hair. She said, that's fine.
The Swim Today ads are making the rounds on social media and will also air this summer on television. I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
Coming up, what's your company's policy on discussing your pay with colleagues?
Don't talk about what you make. Don't talk to your coworkers about money. Don't talk about what the boss makes. Seal up those lips.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average unloaded 70 points, 0.4% to finish at 16,912. The Nasdaq slipped 2 points, a fractional loss, to end the day at 44.42. And the S&P 500 retreated 8 points, 0.4% to close at 1969. Let's start with the food news. Darden Restaurants, the parent company of Olive Garden, plated a 4.3% gain. Its chairman and CEO stepped down yesterday after a battle with activist investors. Video game maker Electronic Arts unplugged 2%, and Microsoft deleted 0.2% after announcing a subscription program for Xbox One players. Herbalife wilted 13.5%. The diet shake and supplement company missed quarterly expectations. Overseas, Germany's DAX and France's CAC 40 bumped up 0.5%. Britain's FTSE stepped up 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.46%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its advance estimate for second quarter gross domestic product. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on pricing policies and competition in the contact lens industry. And tomorrow is National Cheesecake Day. Schedule that and extra miles on the treadmill. Do it now. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Tomorrow, Argentina may default on $13 billion it owes to international creditors. That's unlikely to spark the kind of panic that, say, Cyprus's default did. But Marketplace's Sabri Benishour takes a look at what could happen around the world.
If Argentina defaults, it will not set off some sort of financial contagion. That's because, to use the analogy, to catch a bug from someone, you have to be exposed to them.
They've been shut out of global markets for quite some time.
Stephen Kaplan teaches political science at George Washington University. Ever since Argentina's catastrophic default in 2001, very few people have wanted to lend to the country. But there is another type of contagion that people do worry about.
This could make restructuring for other developing countries far more difficult in the future.
When Argentina defaulted last time, it told its creditors, "We'll give you 30 cents on the dollar. Take it or leave it." 93% took it, 7% left it. Then a tiny percentage of those holdouts sued and said, "We didn't agree to anything. And your contract says if you pay those other guys, you have to pay us." They won.
It says to all investors, instead of settling after a country is facing financial crisis, to hold out and not allow a debt restructuring to take place.
That's Eric LeCompte, who runs Jubilee USA, the religious group that promotes financial reform. He says other countries are already bracing for fallout.
In the state of New York, there are cases that are similar taking place with Grenada and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
But if Argentina does default, the immediate losers are the people who lent the country money and, of course, Argentina. It has tried hard recently to get back into the good graces of international lenders, and default would dash those efforts. Henry Weisberg is a partner at Sherman Sterling.
In certain circumstances, even commercial borrowers in Argentina will have a hard time raising money.
On the other hand, if Argentina does not default, it could open itself up to a deluge of lawsuits from holdout creditors. In other words, Argentina is damned if it defaults and damned if it doesn't. In New York, I'm Sri Benishore for Marketplace.
One of the arguments for the Affordable Care Act was that the law would reduce our dependency on emergency rooms, and it would do that by giving more people access to preventative care. Well, it's been a few months now since Americans signed up for insurance through Obamacare. So are emergency rooms seeing a slowdown? Not so much. From WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, here's Lewis Wallace.
On the street in downtown Dayton, Rebecca Jacobson says before Obamacare,
I didn't have health care. I didn't have anything.
She's racked up thousands in medical bills. Now she's on Medicaid. Ohio's one of the 27 states that expanded that program with federal funds. She was in the emergency room just last month, admittedly not for the most serious problem.
I thought I had lice, and I didn't.
The symptoms?
My head was itching, and they just said I have dandruff.
An ER visit for dandruff. This is just the kind of situation some people will point to and say that's burdening the whole system. Jacobson says she would have gone to a regular doctor to see if she had lice, but it was the middle of the night, and the ER trip didn't cost her anything. Up the road at Miami Valley Hospital, Dr. Darren Pangalangan, who heads emergency services, says he thinks people should be able to use the ER when they need to or think they need to.
You cannot go to your family doctor at midnight. They're not open at midnight.
The big Obamacare question, though, is this. Will people actually depend on ERs less for basic care once they're insured, driving costs down for everyone? Or will more people, like Rebecca Jacobson, go to the ER because, well, now they can?
The cost of going to the emergency department might be a major deterrent for the uninsured.
Catherine Baker is a Harvard health economist who worked on a study of new Medicaid recipients in Oregon. She found that people who got on Medicaid then went to the ER more.
And once they have access to insurance, they can go to the emergency department without being concerned about being presented with an enormous bill at the end.
Howard Mell with the American College of Emergency Physicians says many of his members are seeing more traffic for sure, though ER visits were already on the rise.
Most emergency departments have actually seen an increase in the amount of people coming through the door. It's not a huge increase, but it's certainly noticeable.
But another study in Massachusetts found expanding to near universal health coverage led to less people using emergency rooms in cases where it wasn't really an emergency. So overall, the jury is still out. Some 13 million people are just now settling into having health insurance, either through Medicaid or the ACA exchanges. It's not clear yet how all those people might use the ER differently. And it's not like most people are in a huge rush to go to an emergency room. Take Roberta Gillum, who I meet on her way to the bus in Dayton. She says she recently got Medicaid, and she's been taking advantage of it by getting preventive care, not by going to the ER.
I've had my pap smear, I had my mammograms, had my dentures, my x-rays, and getting ready to get me a partial. It's been a blessing.
It's the safety net she's grateful for.
When anybody can get insurance, you know they're happy to have insurance, especially the ones that can't afford insurance.
And emergency care is really just one small piece of the puzzle. More people getting coverage is likely to mean more use of all kinds of health services. The basic economic principle is when something becomes cheaper for people, they use more of it. In Dayton, Ohio, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Even though it's illegal, many companies ask or strongly encourage employees not to talk about what they make. According to one study, about 51% of women surveyed and 47% of men say conversations about pay are discouraged or prohibited where they work. Nancy Kane of the Harvard Business School is here to talk about these workplace gag rules. Hi, Nancy.
Hey there, David.
Give me an idea of how widespread this is. How common are gag rules, you know, companies telling employees not to talk about what they're making?
So the evidence on gag rules is anecdotal rather than, you know, exhaustively quantitative. But from anecdotal evidence, they look relatively widespread. You know, don't talk about what you make. Don't talk to your coworkers about money. Don't talk about what the boss makes. Seal up those lips. Or, you know, the stringent kind of sticks here are a big deal. Or we'll fire you. Or you'll be demoted. Or we'll dock your pay. So, you know, gag rules are illegal. Right. They were made illegal in the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. But there's no question that they are alive and well in America.
Should we be talking about this more? I just think of this as an issue of propriety, that I'm not somebody who goes around talking about how much I make. And here at my company, I don't have a lot of people asking me how much I make. It seems like it's something that we haven't talked about. We've been encouraged not to talk about just as a matter of culture for a very long time.
That's true. I think there are companies that flout that social norm, if you will. So if you take a company like Whole Foods, right, Whole Foods Market, they publish actually store by store. If you're an employee, you can find out what top management makes. It's you know, it goes under the file folder label open book management. And interestingly enough, right, as much as that flouts social convention, the evidence on how those companies perform in terms of worker engagement, in terms of productivity, in terms of long-term profitability is unambiguous. Those companies do well and better by some measure than average. So are those social norms serving everybody, including shareholders in public companies? Well, I think that's a much more open question.
Seems to me there'd be a lot of downsides to this, not the least of which is that you could be lowballed pretty severely when you're applying for a job, when you're being interviewed for a job.
Absolutely. I mean, there are downsides on the worker side, right, on the supply of labor side, big time, right? So if you have no sense of what your pay is on some kind of ladder, right, of compensation across the organization, you have no sense of, you know, what kind of organization this is in terms of how they reward people for a job well done. So I think, you know, I think there's, you know, there are many disadvantages for workers. Not only, you know, am I being paid fairly, but what am I doing here if I'm not being paid fairly? So there's this little kind of conversation a worker, all of us have every single day when we show up to our work, to be engaged, to not be engaged, to be cheerful, to be productive. That calculator is incredibly important, not only to how well the company functions, transaction by transaction, you know, creation by creation, but also to how the, you know, our workforce in general functions, and P.S. to how well each of us feels about our day's work and how satisfied we feel. And if gag rules undermine that kind of calculation, make it darker, make it, you know, less trustworthy, make people more willing in some sense to say, well, I don't know and I'm not allowed to talk about it. So if I find out that someone makes more, I'm going to do less. I'm going to be less productive. That's bad for the individual and it's bad for the economy and it's bad for our society.
Nancy Kane is an historian at Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, David.
And my colleague David Brancaccio, the host of the Marketplace Morning Report, did a series on workplace pay about a year ago. He looked at this very issue, whether you should tell people how much money you make, and he also looked at why you get paid what you get paid. All that's worth listening to. You can find the series at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, I saw this on Gawker's Domesticity blog after I talked with Nicola Twilley about refrigerators in China. A fridge in the U.S. is, on average, many cubic feet larger than fridges in other countries, twice the size of your average fridge in Europe, for instance. Not only do big refrigerators cost us more money because they take more power to cool, they also may encourage unhealthy eating habits, Dan Nosowitz writes, and he cites a couple of studies. One concludes families that have more food in the house eat more food. Another one says the average American throws out about 25% of food and beverages purchased. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow unloaded 70 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq slipped 2 points, just a fraction of a percent. And the S&P 500 retreated 8 points, 0.4%. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.